bustling streets of Southall. A woman in a black leather jacket.
I'm Gurinder Chadder. I'm a British film director. And in my films, like Bend It Like Beckham and Bargee on the Beach, I've explored and celebrated what it's like to be Asian growing up in this country. Now, I'm delving into my own family story.
Growing up in an Indian or Pakistani family, there's one piece of history that we all know about. It's an event that's had a huge impact on all our lives, the partition of India.
In 1947, the British divided India in two, creating a newly independent India and a new country, Pakistan. People of different faiths turned on each other. 17 million people became refugees overnight, and over a million lost their lives. It was a seismic event that tore apart millions of lives, including my own family's. But why did this happen? Like so much of history, the answer depends on who gets to tell it.
When I was growing up, I was taught at school that the partition of India happened because we, as Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, couldn't get along. In fact, we hated each other. So the British had no choice but to divide the country, and it was our fault. But my mum says the opposite. She says that everybody got along before partition. So there's a major discrepancy here. In this film, I want to explore what really happened 70 years ago. Was partition inevitable? Was it really about religious intolerance? Or were there other reasons why India was divided 70 years ago?
India's partition, the forgotten story. Gurinder's in a kitchen at a family gathering, trying some of the delicacies.
Bhaji, you'll have tea, coffee. Iki chiza. Oh, that looks nice. It's dokra, but made small. Dokri.
I'm starting my journey close to home by visiting my mum and my aunties in West London. They were young girls in 1947, and rarely talk about how they survived partition. As Sikhs, they found themselves living in the new state of Pakistan, which was created as a homeland for India's Muslims. They were forced to flee to India when partition was announced.
What do you remember in 1947? What happened?
One day, Sikh military comes with green lorry, and they says, come on, everybody have to move from here. If you stay here, they will kill you. They put us in the lorry and take to the station.
So there was your mother,
yeah.
There was you two, and another little sister, baby sister.
We stay in the train 3 nights, no food, nothing. My sister was a very bad. She's very bad. My sister died over there.
My family had lived in Jhelum and Rawalpindi for generations. When India was divided in two, they ended up on the wrong side of the border and were no longer welcome. That's why, along with millions of others, they were forced to flee.
I always thought that before these troubles and before partition, everybody used to get on. What was it like before partition with Hindus and Muslims and Sikhs?
They were friends, but just like brothers and sisters and everything.
So how did that feel, living there when you were all together?
Very nice, very just... Never thought that something will happen like this. We never thought. And from their side, up to now, I haven't been in Rawalpindi. And I miss that place very badly. Oh, very sad. It's very sad. The partition thing was very sad. It is written.
An emotional Balwant Kaur Chadder continues, it is written in the history that people write with the gold and the silver words, but this history is written in the blood.
It's clear that the events of 1947 in India have affected my family till today. And I think it's fair to say that all of us who have been affected by partition still live under that shadow. I'd like to find out what happened to the world that my mum talked about, where everybody lived side by side as brother and sister. I'd like to find out where the seeds of partition started.
Driving through a residential street on a bright day.
If everyone got along, as my mum says, why did anyone think Muslims needed a separate homeland? I want to find out where and why the idea of Pakistan was first dreamed up. I've arranged to meet Oxford historian Yasmin Khan, who's studied the roots of partition.
Hello, Yasmin.
Hello.
Nice to see you. So, I thought that I was going to get on a plane to hot, sunny India, but I'm here in suburban Cambridge.
And this is the house where the word Pakistan was coined and where it was first written down in 1933 by a student in Cambridge. So it all kind of originates from here.
So this is the
very place. This is the birthplace of Pakistan.
Oh.
So it's not exactly what you associate with Pakistan.
What's this?
Chowdhury Rahmat Ali. He was a Cambridge student.
Yeah.
He wasn't exactly a young thing. He was already in his late 30s. He'd already done one law degree and he was doing another law degree.
Uh-huh.
And he was living here. He got increasingly interested in the rights of Muslims. He wrote this, Now or Never, Are We to Live or Perish Forever? Very sort of rousing, polemical tract. And he was committed to the idea of Muslims living separately to Indians and the idea that India couldn't be a plural, sort of mixed place.
And where did the word Pakistan, like, did he just come up with that in his head?
Or? Well, some people say he thought of it on the top of a London bus, but it actually, the first time it was written down was in this house. The thing that made it distinctive is because each letter stands for a different part of Pakistan.
Ah, okay, so
he is Punjab. A is Afghanistan, but he meant it to mean the northwest frontier. K is Kashmir. S, Sindh. And then the Stan bit is for Balochistan. And then Pakistan itself means land of the pure.
Right.
So it had this resonance.
So here he is, writing these pamphlets, coming up with these ideas. Mm. Was anyone in India listening to him?
Not really. In India, nobody was really thinking about a separate homeland for Indian Muslims at that point. And so his ideas were pretty marginal.
Yeah.
A street sign reading Humberstone Road.
Leafy suburban Cambridge is the last place where I would have expected Pakistan to be born. But what is interesting about what Yasmin says is that nobody was interested in a separate homeland for Muslims at this point. So what happened? What changed?
How, in less than 15 years, did the whimsical dream of a Cambridge student become a nation of 31 million people? To find out, I need to go to India's capital, where the idea of partition first took hold.
A dotted line extends from London over Europe and the Middle East to land in Delhi. Bustling, hazy streets filled with tuk-tuks, buses and mopeds. Then Gurinder walking amongst the throng.
That's a road rage, road rage.
In the 1930s, Delhi was the beating heart of the largest empire in the history of the world. The British had ruled India for almost 200 years, a few thousand white Christians governing over 400 million Indians of all creeds and religions.
Kya padha aapne school se? English? Hindi, Hindi.
This is Old Delhi, and here you have Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, all working together, living on top of each other still, just like my aunts and my mum were talking about. You've got Sikh temples, Hindu temples, mosques that have been here for centuries. So here you have a thriving, kind of bustling, very mixed community still.
Back in the 30s, the majority of Indians were Hindus. But a quarter of the population was Muslim.
and there was also a significant Sikh minority. But for the most part, the different religions did live together in peace. So how did the divide between them begin?
She meets a tall man.
Indian MP and historian Shashi Tharoor has recently written a book about the British rule of India.
The communities in India are living side by side. What made things change?
Well, I think principally it was a very deliberate and conscious British decision to separate, because in Indian unity would lie the biggest threat to the British Empire.
So are you saying the British started instigating a new form of rule and approach to India? What was that called?
It was called divide and rule. It was called divide and rule by the British themselves. Systematic efforts were made to foment a separate Muslim consciousness, whether it was in creating Muslim institutions, including educational institutions, in specifically favoring people on the basis of community, to the extent that when Indians were allowed to vote, the British created separate electorates in which Muslims could only vote for Muslim candidates to represent them. Something they would have never countenanced back home in England. One can't imagine the Jews of Golders Green having a separate list to vote only for Jewish representatives. But the British did that in India very deliberately as part of divide and rule. And so it went all the way right through the 30s and 40s.
Was anybody calling for a separate state of Pakistan?
Oh, only a few cranks, really. And in fact, the vast majority of Indian Muslims did not subscribe to this. It was still very much a minority view.
A cyclist rides around a small woman sweeping the road ahead.
So, according to Shashi, the British policy of divide and rule was a deliberate attempt to weaken the Indian people and stop them from challenging British rule. They encouraged Hindus, Muslims and Sikhs to view themselves as different from each other. And in some parts of India, Muslims were increasingly seen as inferior by some Hindus. But nobody was yet calling for Pakistan. Instead, since the 1920s, most Indians had been fighting for one thing: an independent India free from British rule. The problem was that few could agree on what shape it would take. Three men drove the fight for independence: Mahatma Gandhi, and Pandit Nehru led India's largest political party, Congress. This was an alliance of Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs who campaigned for an independent India where all religions would live side by side. Muhammad Ali Jinnah led the Muslim League, which was concerned with protecting Muslim minority rights. To find out more about these three men, I've come to see writer William Dalrymple, who lives in Delhi.
So, William, it's lovely to see you here in India, in your natural habitat. Can you tell me something about the leading characters, the players of the time?
When historians talk about the great events of history, they often draw on great historical forces, changes in economies, changes in climate. But with partition, a lot of it is simply due to the personalities of the three principal players and the way that two of them get on very well, Nehru and Gandhi, despite being very different men, and the fact that neither of them like personally Jinnah. And yet they should have got on. They were all anglicised lawyers, all went to London and studied in London, studied the bar. All of them returned to India wanting to free India.
And as a personality?
If you'd had a dinner party today, Nehru is the one of the three you'd have wanted as the guest. He's enormously handsome, enormously charming, writes beautifully, is in many ways a wunderkind. Jinnah, he was a staunch secularist, he was a rationalist, quite a dry character with a brilliant academic mind. Gandhi sheds his suits and wears homespun, becomes the Mahatma, and brings his ideas of spiritual regeneration into politics. And Jinnah thought this was hogwash. He thought that Gandhi was bringing religion, Hinduism, into politics by having prayers at prayer meetings in political rallies. He eventually, reluctantly, takes the view that Muslims have to look after themselves. And that's a long and important journey, and one that leads him to personally falling out with Gandhi and Nehru.
William told me that in the 1930s, Nehru and Gandhi began to scorn Jinnah, and relations between the three men deteriorated. They reached a new low in 1937 after elections for provincial government were held across India.
Congress sweeps the board, the Muslim League does very badly, but Jinnah believes that it has been established between him and Congress that they will be sharing power, whatever the results. There will be some Muslim League representation, and he's not given it. Buoyed up with the confidence of their victory, Congress sweep him aside as a minor irrelevance. Jinnah feels he's been double-crossed, and it's at this point that the bitterness between the principal players becomes, in a way, irreconcilable.
According to William, Jinnah saw his treatment by Congress as a warning that in future, Muslim religion and culture would be ignored. And the growing suspicion between these three politicians would now, unwittingly, propel them along the path to partition. But Jinnah wasn't yet calling for a separate Muslim homeland. All that was about to change.
A news title reading War.
With the outbreak of the Second World War in 1939, India was dragged into the conflict. Britain needed soldiers, so she turned to the colonies to provide them. Congress refused to support the imperialist rulers' war and resigned in protest. Its leaders were then thrown in jail. For Congress, this was a fatal mistake. Locked away, they created a power vacuum. Jinnah filled it by declaring his support for the British war effort. Then, in March 1940, in Lahore, Jinnah made a speech that would change history.
A photo of a suited Jinnah in front of a microphone. The domed spire of a minaret. Then a translated sign reading, "None to be worshipped but Allah."
So at this point, I really wanted to go to Pakistan to learn more about Jinnah and his speech in Lahore, but I've been denied a visa. This is probably because of the tension between India and Pakistan right now, and it's a real tragedy for me because my ancestral homeland is there in Pakistan. And since I can't go to Pakistan, I've come back to my adopted homeland of Southall.
A chef working at a flaming hob in a kitchen.
I've asked Yasmin Khan to meet me again to explain the significance of what happened in Lahore.
So, Yasmin, tell me about Jinnah's speech in 1940 in Lahore.
So, Jinnah, in 1940, gives a speech which really revolutionises the Muslim League. It really changes everything for him. But what's important about it is that he talks about a Muslim homeland or Muslim states for the first time. Well, I've got a bit here. He says, "Muslims are a nation according to any definition of a nation, and they must have their homelands, their territory, and their state." So he's starting to really articulate something different and new, which is grabbing the attention of people who in the past hadn't supported the Muslim League.
So that was a turning point.
It's a huge turning point. It's a pivotal moment, really, because people suddenly think the Muslim League isn't just campaigning for Muslim rights in India, they may also be campaigning for a separate state or states.
So suddenly this idea of a separate country
was
quite radical, right?
It is radical.
Why do you think he chose this particular moment to make this speech?
Yeah, it's March 1940, so the Second World War is just a few months old. It's thrown Congress into disarray. So Jinnah uses that to seize the moment.
As these calls for separatism started to gain popularity with ordinary people. What were the other signs of divisions that you saw happening?
Yeah, there are little things that start to creep in. People being very wary about their neighbours, perhaps starting to have economic ideas of nationalism. So they'll just buy from a Hindu or buy from a Muslim shopkeeper rather than going to the market before and buying from everybody. There's more and more kind of unpleasant kind of characterization of the other happening in newspapers, in popular pamphlets, using inflammatory language, and who were trying to, on all sides, trying to sort of rally their supporters.
By the kitchen.
So what's interesting about what Yasmin says is that the genie was finally out of the bottle. Here was a politician standing up and saying India needed to be divided, Muslims wanted their own separate homeland called Pakistan. But partition was still not inevitable at this point. Most Muslims didn't want a separate homeland. So what changed?
A train leaves a tunnel into a tropical wilderness. Gurinder looks out of the window at a jungle valley.
To find out how partition came a step closer, I need to travel back to India and head to the foothills of the Himalayas.
The dotted line travels north of Delhi to Shimla, relatively close to the border.
In June 1945, the war was over. During the past 5 years, most Indian people had supported the British war effort, providing thousands of troops and nurses. In return, the British had promised them self-rule at the end of the war. Now they had to deliver. They announced a conference to be held in the summer retreat of the Raj, Shimla.
Distinctly British-looking buildings.
This was where the British rulers of India moved every summer to avoid the heat of Delhi.
This is my mum's favourite.
It looks like peanut brittle. Mm.
It was a little England in the Indian hills.
Archive footage of a signpost for Shimla. Then masses of people on a road as Mahatma Gandhi walks along.
The aim of the conference was to decide the political future of India. With the Congress leaders released from jail, India's politicians came here to meet with Viceroy Wavell, the British government's representative in India. If successful, the conference would pave the way for a united, independent India. But could all sides ever see eye to eye?
Clouds gather over Simla for the opening of Lord Wavell's conference with the Indian leaders.
Walking with a man in a polo neck.
To find out what happened, I'm meeting local historian Raja Basin, who's written about the conference.
How did Jinnah react to this conference?
Wavell found Jinnah argumentative. He simply wouldn't budge from whatever stand he had taken on anything. He remained aloof, distant. He is the man who's standing away with his back towards everyone else. He remained adamant that the Muslim League will represent all Muslims in the Indian subcontinent, and no one else has the right to do so. Not the other Muslim parties, not the Congress.
So Jinnah took quite an audacious position, some might say, by not willing to negotiate with anybody, not Wavell, not Congress. Do you think he was trying to derail the conference?
Yes. Even Wavell went on record to say that it had failed, that a similar conference had failed. But from Jinnah's point of view, it was a great success. For one, he emerged as the undisputed leader of the Muslim community. He came away from the conference having got what he wanted.
Tightly packed buildings making up a tiered settlement on the slopes of a hill, then black and white footage of the settlement.
Raja explained that the conference catapulted Jinnah to political stardom. It showed India's Muslims that Jinnah was the man to stand up for their rights against the Hindu majority. He convinced them that Pakistan was better than being second-class citizens in a Hindu-dominated India.
So after talking to Raja, it's clear that here in Shimla in June 1945, Jinnah knew exactly what he wanted to come out of this conference, and he was going for it. He was intransigent and very firm in fighting for what he wanted. Jinnah was the star now. Jinnah had the power, and it seems partition was getting closer and closer.
The Labour landslide.
Labour will now have a majority over all parties in a house of 640.
Just 1 month later, in July 1945, Clement Attlee's new Labour government meant a new future for India. Attlee's priority was to get Britain out as quickly as possible. After 6 years of war, Britain was bankrupt, and India was a massive drain on British resources. So the British announced elections for an Indian national government to help them run the country in the lead-up to independence. But these elections would divide the Indian people even further along religious lines. While Congress campaigned for a united India, the Muslim League declared that a vote for them was a vote for Pakistan. But Hindu hardliners dismissed Pakistan as an absurd concept.
The Indian flag fluttering in the breeze.
These were the elections that really brought religion into politics. By taking up the slogan of a vote for Pakistan is a vote for Islam, Jinnah changed everything. Once he started that kind of sloganeering, other communities started questioning themselves. You had the Sikhs calling for their own separate homeland. This was not what Congress had been fighting for.
A young woman sips a drink on the phone.
Religious identity was being used by all parties to turn the Indian people against each other. I want to know how the British rulers of India now propose to deal with the rising tension between the different communities. And to find that out, I need to go back to Delhi.
The sun sets over the hilltop settlement. Daytime. Gurinder's riding in a tuk-tuk on a busy road with distant buildings almost masked in a haze.
By early 1946, anti-British feeling was on the rise. Attlee was under pressure to come up with an exit strategy. So, in March, the British formulated a plan for Indian independence that they felt might be acceptable to both sides. The Cabinet Mission Plan proposed the united India demanded by Congress. As a concession to the Muslim League, it also proposed giving them almost complete power over the areas they governed. They would run everything apart from defence and foreign affairs, which would be controlled centrally. Although the plan didn't give Jinnah his Pakistan, he accepted it. I've come back to see William Dalrymple to find out why Jinnah said yes.
Everyone expects Jinnah to reject it because he's been very strong on the idea of Pakistan, an entirely separate country. But the offer put on the table by the Cabinet Mission is so strong, with such powers given to the regions, that Jinnah, to everyone's amazement, actually accepts it. And then, to everyone's equal surprise, it's Congress that rejects it. And the person who's militating most strongly against it is Nehru.
So why did Nehru in particular and Congress reject this plan?
Congress rejected the Cabinet Mission plan for exactly the same reason that Jinnah accepted it, because there were very strong powers given to the regions and to the different states. And for Nehru, this meant that there would be a balkanized India, one strung out, weak, without any central authority. And at this point, Nehru is looking admiringly at Soviet Russia. He likes central planning. And he wants a country which can hold together. And he rejects the Cabinet Mission plan. And at that point, for the first time, partition seems inevitable.
On a train passing through countryside and built-up urban areas.
Pakistan, an idea which had only been dreamt up 13 years earlier, was now closer than ever. India's politicians were in deadlock, and violence between Hindus, Sikhs and Muslims was breaking out in many places. To understand why this was happening, I have to travel to India's old colonial capital, Calcutta.
On the map, a long winding line from Delhi to Calcutta. The sun's beaming through a sheen of haze over the serene rooftops of the quiet city. A man strolls along his flat roof and leans against a low wall. Men wash and brush their teeth at a public wash area, and another man carries an oversized load on his head as he crosses a street. In a taxi, Gurinder passes a five-story red brick house, and she points to a grand domed building up ahead.
Look at this monument here.
A building with a pediment and spire.
Looks like I could be in the city right now, in London. But of course I'm not. I'm here in Calcutta, a city I've never visited. This was the home of the British for over 200 years. We're here because in 1946, this is where the independence struggle for a free India, which up till now had been incredibly peaceful, led by Gandhi's a non-violent movement, it was here that things suddenly changed and became the opposite.
A taxi drives past the domed building, which has a clock above its colonnade, a burning pile of paper in a grassy park.
This is the Maidan, a huge park in the centre of Calcutta. Following Nehru's rejection of the cabinet mission, Jinnah called for a direct action day, a Muslim general strike across India, that was to be held on the 16th of August, 1946. In Calcutta, thousands of Muslims gathered here to demand Pakistan. The city was divided almost equally between Hindus and Muslims, and religious tensions had been growing for months.
Photos of a riot.
When the meeting ended, some Muslims attacked Hindu areas of the city. Hindus retaliated, and the violence quickly escalated. Ashok Chaudhary and Abid Mulla were children when the riots broke out. They watched as the violence unfolded. Abid is Muslim, Ashok is Hindu. In August 1946,
what do you remember? Abid says, on that day in Calcutta, there was all this fighting and chaos, fighting between one party and another, fighting between Hindus and Muslims. The library was looted. Gurinder asks, did anyone die? Yes, we heard that five people died in Raja Bazaar. 10 people died in Belegata. What did your mother and father tell you? Do not venture outside. There is a Hindu area next door. If you go there, they will kill you. And Hindus were told they would be killed if they came to this Muslim area. So we were not allowed to go outside.
The main feeling was that of panic. Everybody was panicking. Nobody moved alone. Everybody tried to move in a company. Some four or five together, and with some sort of material for his defense. Maybe knife, maybe bricks, something for his defense.
Bodies lying in a street, one lying directly on a tram line.
The killing continued for 3 days.
Bodies lying amongst debris.
At least 5,000 people were killed.
Strolling with a spectacled man.
Historian Suranjan Das is the world's leading authority on the Calcutta riots.
I want to know why the violence was so extreme.
The fight for Pakistan was actually projected as a holy war. There were new newspapers coming in from the Muslim side. There were pamphlets coming in from the Muslim side. There were large-scale demonstrations that were organized in support of Pakistan.
How did the Hindu leaders react to the Muslim League's call for Day of Action?
Well, the Hindus were also not less prepared. The Hindus had realized that there could be troubles, that just as the Muslim League was organizing themselves, they had also organized themselves.
Sarenjan explained how the violence was allowed to go on unchecked. The British governor of Calcutta refused to bring out the troops until it was too late.
If the British governor had intervened at the right time, in the right way, I feel the violence would not have taken the proportion that it did. I wonder why the British governor was not that forthcoming in introducing troops. It was evident that they would have to leave India. When and how, it was only a matter of time. So that acted as a factor in psychology.
So they didn't want to get involved?
They didn't want to get involved. And as a result, there was the worst communal hysteria that Bengal saw. It showed that partition was the only way out.
A derelict boat on a riverbank. Then the helmsman of a ferry steering his vessel towards the sun.
So as I leave Calcutta, I really believe that the sad events of August 1946 were a real victory for divide and rule. Hatred and violence entered the political arena here in India in a big way. A precedent had been set. And where were the British during all this? They were still the rulers of this country. They could have stopped the rioting like that, but they chose not to. And was it because they couldn't be bothered? Was it because they didn't care about Hindus and Muslims killing each other? Or was there something else going on behind the scenes?
From Gurinder standing at the bow of the ferry to a London bus driving past the Houses of Parliament, Gurinder's driven past Horse Guards Parade.
Back in London, Attlee was appalled by the violence in Calcutta. He summoned the Indian politicians to yet another conference, this time in Downing Street, to knock heads together and find a solution. Predictably, they couldn't come to an agreement. Nehru flew straight home, but Jinnah didn't.
Jinnah stayed behind for 2 weeks in London, meeting various dignitaries and members of the British establishment, one of which was Winston Churchill. And you don't get more establishment than him.
Churchill's statue.
So why did Jinnah stay behind to meet Churchill, now leader of the opposition?
Thank you.
What was going on here?
A young woman with dyed blue hair in a gentleman's club.
Historian Alex von Tunzelmann has written about Jinnah's relationship with Churchill.
Why was Churchill cozying up to Jinnah?
Well, Churchill had had an interest in the idea of Pakistan for quite a long time. He'd always had quite a negative attitude towards India. He famously had said, "I hate Indians, they're a beastly people with a beastly religion." And really there he was talking about Hindus, certainly people of Churchill's generation. There's a perception that Muslims are much more like us, like British people. They have one God. They were seen as much more kind of natural allies of the West, whereas Hindus, a lot of British people found very hard to understand. Lots of gods, a confusing religion, a very different feeling culture. So a lot of people like of Churchill's generation discovered that they felt closer to Muslims than Hindus.
So tell me what happened in 1946 when the leaders came to England.
Well, Churchill invited Jinnah to Chartwell, his country house, on the 7th of December. Now, we don't have a record of what happened during that lunch, but we know that it went very well because afterwards there was this extraordinary letter that Churchill wrote to Jinnah. Got a copy of the letter here. It says, "My dear Mr. Jinnah, I should greatly like to accept your kind invitation to luncheon on December the 12th. I feel, however, that it would perhaps be wiser for us not to be associated publicly at this juncture. I greatly valued our talk the other day, and I now enclose the address to which any telegrams you may wish to send me can be sent without attracting attention in India. So this is a fascinating letter, which implies that the two men probably had a secret correspondence afterwards. It's clearly very warm, clearly they got on well, but Churchill realised that it would be bad to be seen publicly with Jinnah, so there was this idea of having a secret correspondence.
Was it only Churchill that he was seeing? Or what was the feeling of the British establishment at that time?
Well, actually, it wasn't just Churchill. We know that he also met the King and Queen at that time. He went to Buckingham Palace and met them. And Jinnah was very impressed when he met the King and Queen because he found, in his words, that they were 100% Pakistan. They fully supported his idea.
Already, I had the opportunity of meeting some friends, and I might yet find more friends.
No one knows whether the King and Queen really supported Pakistan, as Jinnah claimed. But as Alex explained, there were some people in the British establishment, like Churchill, who did support the creation of Pakistan. Why was that? I recently made a feature film, Viceroy's House, which relives what happened in the dramatic weeks immediately before partition. It looks at what the British were thinking as they prepared to leave India. While I was writing the film, I came across documents which I believe helped to explain why some in the British establishment supported partition. In the archives of the British Library is a document marked Most Secret. It was written by the military chiefs of staff for Churchill when he was still Prime Minister. Yasmin Khan has studied it.
So what do we have here, Yasmin?
Well, this document was produced just before the very end of the war, in May 1945. And what it shows us is just how nervous and worried the military, the British military, were about the prospects of Indian independence. India had always been this sort of linchpin. You know, it was the pivotal place between the Middle East and Southeast Asia. And they're very worried about the sort of future security of South Asia if Britain aren't there. In particular, the idea that Russia will push down and bring communist influence from the north.
So you're talking about the Cold War?
Talking about the Cold War, definitely. I mean, this is all about the threat of Soviet influence in Asia and of the Russian threat to India in particular. So they're really concerned to be able to keep that presence or to keep that influence, that military influence. I mean, there's a very interesting sentence here where it says, it's of paramount importance that India should not secede from the empire or remain neutral in war, which is really saying that they want to be able to dictate Indian foreign policy in the future.
So what are the conclusions?
What they know they want is a strategic reserve in India that's centrally placed, with airfields that they can control, and with a reserve which could operate in war and be used outside of India in the region. Now, the problem they have is they know full well the Congress Party and the Indian Nationalists are unlikely to allow that to happen. And so one of the solutions they suggest is that Baluchistan, which is now part of Pakistan, could be perhaps not included in the Dominion, and therefore used as a place to station reserves.
So it's basically saying, if we carve off a little bit of India, a place that exists at the moment as India, but if we carve it off, we can make that a military base.
Yeah.
So were there then people in the British camp who saw a particular role for Pakistan based on this document?
There would have been people who would have seen it as potentially a way of maintaining British influence in the region in a way that they couldn't with a united India.
This wasn't the official government line. Attlee always stated that he wanted to leave behind a united India. But as Yasmin says, there were some people in the British establishment who favoured strategic considerations over Indian unity.
So clearly there was a much bigger global agenda here. And I believe that Nehru and Gandhi never realised how significant India was in this new post-war map of the world. On the other hand, I think Jinnah, with his friends in England, did. And I believe he knew that if he could give them politically and strategically what they wanted, he would get his Pakistan.
A double-decker bus crosses a bridge at night.
With Nehru and Jinnah in deadlock, the British government finally took decisive action. On 20th of February 1947, Attlee told Parliament that Britain would leave India no later than June 1948, with or without any agreement between Nehru and Jinnah. When Clement Attlee made his announcement here 70 years ago, the news was received with great relief in India. The British Raj would finally be over. But what was that independent India going to look like? With so many agendas at play, who was going to win out?
Speeded up footage of a dense city block in India with traffic speeding through a junction. A local man with a white beard is wearing a towel draped over his head. Gurinder's wearing a yellow sash over her patterned blouse.
Back in Delhi, the end game of independence was about to begin. To carry out the final negotiations, Attlee sent a big hitter to be the new viceroy.
Mountbatten takes over.
At Delhi, Lord Louis Mountbatten arrives to take up his appointment as India's Viceroy and Governor-General. At a crucial moment in India's history, the 47-year-old grandson of Queen Victoria becomes the 29th and last Viceroy.
A grand palace.
In March 1947, Mountbatten arrived here in Viceroy's house. This magnificent palace had been built and completed only a decade earlier to house the British rulers of India. And here, in these corridors of power, Mountbatten oversaw the negotiations for the final end of British rule.
An Indian flag on a dome.
Mountbatten was chosen because, as a decorated war hero and relation of the king, it was hoped the Indian leaders would see him as an honest broker. Officially, at least, a united India was still on the cards, and Mountbatten was seen as the man who could deliver it. But was it really still a possibility?
As I was growing up, I had always been told that Mountbatten arrived in India hoping to give India back as a unified country.
I find that, honestly, somewhat implausible. By the time Mountbatten arrived in March 47, you had seen not only Wavell's failure, the previous viceroy, but you had seen the violence having begun, particularly with Direct Action Day in August of 1946 in Calcutta. And so I think he came in as a credible face of sort of well-meaning British attempt to find a solution acceptable to all. But very clearly, the British establishment behind him had, in my view, decided that partition was the only way out. The first few weeks of negotiating convinced Mountbatten, I think, there was no way forward.
Mountbatten smiling with statesmen.
With all sides at loggerheads, Mountbatten quickly realised that partition was the only workable solution. Nehru reluctantly accepted that if he wanted to keep control over most of India, then he would have to give Jinnah Pakistan. All parties now agreed to India being split in two.
Grand archways in line with each other.
With violence spreading across northern India, Mountbatten now made a dramatic announcement. Partition would not take place in June 1948, as planned, but 10 months earlier, in August 1947, now just weeks away.
Why do you think he brought the date forward?
Well, I think there was a perception that matters were spiralling out of control. The British felt that they didn't want to be holding the reins while this happened. They didn't want to be blamed. and therefore they thought if they made their exit sooner rather than later, the Indians could kill themselves and wouldn't be the British's problem. I mean, that seems a cynical way of putting it, but I think almost certainly that seems to have been their thinking.
So you think they were rats leaving a sinking ship?
I'm afraid so, yeah. The British the British scuttled. They actually sank the ship first, and then they swam away from it.
A map of India.
The agreed plan gave Pakistan the Muslim-majority provinces in the north. Jinnah had also wanted the wealthy provinces of Bengal and the Punjab. But as these were religiously mixed, the British decided to divide them between India and Pakistan, tearing them in two. They would keep the precise details of the new border secret until after independence, so as not to overshadow the celebrations.
East and West Pakistan on either ends of India.
Nobody was happy with the Mountbatten plan. The Muslims ended up with a Pakistan which they called moth-eaten. The Hindus ended up with a divided India. And the Sikhs lost huge tracts of their religious and holy lands. Everybody was unhappy except the British, who couldn't wait to get out fast enough.
Red and white uniformed cavalry escorting a horse-drawn carriage bearing a man in white uniform saluting regally.
Just 2 months later, on the 15th of August 1947, the newly created countries of Pakistan and India were declared independent. Nehru was sworn in as the first Prime Minister of India. Jinnah as the first Governor General of Pakistan. But as millions celebrated, parts of India and Pakistan were about to explode in more violence.
Archive footage of a badly injured man lying on a makeshift bed, a woman with head injuries, then a covered body on a street.
The day after independence, the precise details of the line dividing the Punjab and Bengal was announced. Millions of people found themselves on the wrong side of the border. On the Indian side, gangs of Sikhs and Hindus attacked Muslims. On the Pakistan side, gangs of Muslims attacked Hindus and Sikhs. This was largely the work of organized militia, grabbing land and property. As children, Dilip Raj Aneja and Kuldeep Kaur witnessed attacks on the villages where they lived.
Dilik says, suddenly five or six men appeared. They carried spears and axes in their hands. My father's elder brother had a problem with his knees and he was sitting in the bullock cart. I saw that someone hit his head with a stick and he fell there. My grandfather too was hit with a stick and he too died. They threw two spears at me. I shouted, don't kill me, I'm a child. One spear missed me in front of me and the others missed behind me. Kuldeep says, in the village, all the women jumped into the well. Why? Because they were being raped. They would grab them and take them away. They had killed their men, and so all the women jumped into the well. They all died.
Oh, my goodness.
In Rawalpindi, they stripped bare Hindu and Sikh women and walked them in a procession, and they sliced off their breasts. After that, they killed Hindus and Sikhs, filled a train with their bodies, and sent it to India.
Fifth
For every Sikh and Hindu woman who was killed, a Muslim woman was killed too. The violence was on all sides. Both Nehru and Jinnah expressed their dismay at the violence. But neither they nor the British had planned for the scale of the upheaval.
Refugees walking in long lines through the dusty countryside.
An estimated 17 million people fled their homes. And at least a million men, women and children lost their lives.
A frail, wailing child.
It's just awful and harrowing. And it's hard because I imagine my own family being caught up in all that tragedy too, and my aunt who starved to death at that time, you know, would have been, you know, my aunt living today. The other thing that I just find very hard to deal with is just how explosive it was on all sides. As many Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs died, you know, everybody was a victim.
A cargo plane taxiing on a runway.
During the Cold War, Pakistan became a loyal ally to the West, just as Churchill had wanted.
A fighter jet on a strafing run.
But Pakistan's relations with India have been beset by distrust and conflict.
Artillery fire.
There have been three wars between the two countries since 1947. And today, they both have nuclear weapons aimed at each other.
A candy floss seller.
Yet, there was nothing inevitable about partition. It was politicians, not ordinary Indians, who were the driving force behind it. First the British, with divide and rule, and then some of India's leaders, encouraged religious difference as a weapon to win power.
Two small boys with Pakistani flags, then stands filled with flag-waving Pakistani people.
But now, 70 years later, as India and Pakistan celebrate their anniversaries, I believe it's time to forge a new relationship. Both nations have committed citizens who love their countries, along with thriving communities all over the world.
And this is the community that I'm now a big part of, British Asians.
She hugs a white-bearded man.
After 200 years of British rule, all our history and cultures are intertwined. I grew up here in Southall with Christians, Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, sharing and appreciating each other's cultures. We long left the divisions brought about by partition behind us. And what that tells me is though religion and culture are important in defining who we are, that doesn't mean they need to divide us. Rather, I believe they should enrich us. And that's something worth celebrating today and for future generations.